Hi, welcome back to the TT Wine Explorer podcast. I'm Tanya Tomaszewska. As many of you know, I live in Vancouver, British Columbia, on the Pacific West Coast of Canada. We have a local wine industry here in British Columbia, which has seen exponential growth over the past 10 to 15 years in particular. And I spend a considerable amount of time in our local wine regions. But I also love to hit the road and try wine in other lands. For me, a fantastic place to wine explore is London, England. I'd not been to London for several years, but was very fortunate to travel there twice during the past 2 years. A historic hub for wine trade and media, London has developed an incredible gastronomic scene. One could spend a year there exploring wine from all over the world just by hanging out in wine bars, restaurants, pubs, tasting events, local bottle shops, and grocery stores, the shelves of which are lined with so many things which I just don't see in Canada. And it was in one of these scenes during my last two trips to England that I was able to catch up with my friend Beth Willard. Beth is a wine expert and an Aussie, one of my favorite combinations. Beth has lived in London for a while now and has developed deep expertise in her field through many experiences, including as a wine buyer, a wine writer, and a wine judge. She is a specialist in Spanish and Central European wines in particular. But in my experience, Beth knows a lot about wines from a lot of places. Quite frankly, Beth is an expert drinker, and I mean that in all the best possible ways and with the greatest respect. And a testament to this is that Beth was recently appointed by Decanter Magazine to be one of the co-chairs of judges for Decanter's World Wine Awards this year. For those not familiar with it, Decanter is one of the world's leading wine magazines. Decanter's wine awards and ratings are followed by producers and consumers globally. This is a big deal. I have a very clear and vivid memory of the first time I met Beth. She and I were attending the wine executive program at the University of California, Davis. I was sitting in one of the lecture rooms waiting for one of the course's speakers to begin, and I struck up a conversation with the gal next to me. It was Beth. She was so down to earth. She loved to have a laugh. And brilliantly for me, she was really open to using the Aussie vernacular and quoting clips from Aussie TV shows and movies, things that I had really been missing from my time living in Australia. When the UC Davis course wrapped, Beth and I went wine tasting with a few other people at wineries around St. Helena and Calistoga in Napa Valley. It was an amazing day. I felt that I'd known Beth forever, and we've kept in touch ever since. I've always loved wine exploring with Beth and my chats with her. I hope that you enjoy our discussion today. Let's fly. Hi, Beth. Thanks so much for joining as my guest today.
Hi. I love the introduction. I actually do tell people I'm an expert drinker.
I know, I loved it. I didn't think you'd mind if I repeated that. Expert drinker always.
Expert drinker within a professional context, of course.
Correct. Let's make sure we qualify that and refine that. We have so much to talk about. We always do. So I'm going to try and be very targeted in this conversation today. I feel mm-hmm. we could have lots of follow-on episodes. Before we dive into a few aspects of the wine world that you're traversing now, and just for the benefit of my listeners who I think, you know, who may not know you or have not met you in person, I'd love to just chat a little bit about your background and how you got to where you are now. And you're in Spain at the moment, and we'll get to that.
Sure. Yeah.
So one of the things that I remember, the first things you told me about yourself is that you speak a lot of languages. I mean, Spanish and Russian, just to name a few. You're from Australia, but you live in London now. You've had lots of travels. So, you know, what's the snapshot in terms of, you know, how did this start for you? What prompted your journey in the world of wine? What was the springboard into it?
It's a really, I guess I'm a kind of weird, rare combination of things as an Australian. I think growing up, like I was really lucky because, well, I should put some context around this. My parents were both originally teachers, and they were both language teachers. So my mum was a Latin and ancient Greek teacher, which again is a fairly rare combination for an Australian. And my dad was a French and German teacher. And it's not, they never ever forced me into following their footsteps, but I was always exposed to wonderful books and literature and films at home. And so I think it just sort of crept into me as well. And so I studied languages at school and, of course, never asked for any help because anybody who knows me knows I'm very stubborn as well. But I think it was just that exposure to the outside world. So I was so lucky to have parents like that who just, you know, from our house in Sydney, tried to give me and my sister exposure to everything. But it was really hard kind of finding my way into something that I wanted to pursue because I really do love everything. So, you know, I tried, you know, playing, I sort of was into music as well at school. I did debating. I was very sporty. I played every sport. And if anybody who knows me knows that I'm obsessed with cricket and I played cricket. It was sort of my entire life for a long time. It still sort of is, but I try to keep it in the background in the wine world. So, you know, I was trying to combine all of these things and I studied languages right through into university. And then I was looking for a way to use them really and give me an opportunity to travel and to live abroad. And it's not that I mean, I absolutely love Australia and I love going back there, but I just love being around other cultures as well. So I was looking for something that would give me that avenue. And I guess the other thing with my parents is that every year we would travel down to Melbourne once or twice a year to visit relatives. And we would always stop along the way because it was such a long trip. And we'd go to wineries because mum and dad loved to drink wine. And as a child, you know, you hate it. You dragged around these wineries and it's super boring. But I guess it kind of exposed me to that world really young. And I still now can remember smells and sensations of being in those wineries. So when I started, you know, to drink when I was, you know, at university in my early 20s, I guess I was a bit more interested in wine than just, you know, glugging it in a bar. Mm-hmm. And then I ended up in France teaching English because I'd studied French at university as well. And then, you know, I was given a choice of places where I could go and I intentionally put Bordeaux and Burgundy as options thinking, well, let's see what happens. So I ended up in Bordeaux and it really became like a second home to me. And I went back a few years later then as well. And I actually ended up working in Bordeaux for the syndicate of Bordeaux, Bordeaux Supérieur, the appellations, the basic appellations in the region. And so that was really the springboard. And I went back to Australia, worked in a winery there and then came back to Europe. And it sort of all took off from there. But it was just a way to get out and meet people because that's what wine's all about, isn't it? It's about bringing people together.
So you ended up in London, and I think when we met at UC Davis at that mm-hmm. time, as I recall, you were working for a company called Direct Wine. Is that right? And as I recall, one of the roles I think that you were involved in was working with some other industry professionals to curate wine clubs for certain companies or publications. Now, mm-hmm. this was before COVID-19, when, you know, at least here in North America and Canada, there was a huge explosion of online wine clubs or virtual wine clubs and curations because that's how people, you know, producers got wine to the people. But you were involved in this before that. So just because of that, you know, what kinds of trends were you seeing then? And have you seen a shift since then? I know that's a really broad question, but maybe there are some, yeah. You know, here I kind of feel there was a big explosion of wine clubs and now maybe a little bit of a dissipation now, and producers are and agents are seeing what's the mm-hmm. best way to connect with people both virtually and in real life. So, you know, what are your observations, I guess, having had that experience?
Yeah. It's a really interesting question because I mean, there are a lot of different components to it. I guess I can start by just giving a bit of context around Direct Wines. It was started by Tony Lathwaite in the UK, and he basically started with him getting a van and going to Bordeaux. He didn't really know what he was doing in his life either, but he'd spent some time sort of, you know, just wasting time really around Bordeaux, and he got to know some producers, and so he thought, oh, he'd get a van, and he basically took those wines back to you know, some the railway arches, and he set up sort of a stall there. And just sold directly to the public. And then when that ran out, he would go back to Bordeaux and then come back again. And so it was a very direct-to-consumer model. And eventually he ended up partnering with the Sunday Times and established the wine club with the Sunday Times. So it was an interesting thing to go into because it was a very established business and a very successful business. But at the same time, it was going through changes because it was going from a wine club subscription model, which was very paper-based and everybody would receive a catalogue and they'd see all the wines, like a physical catalogue. But obviously at the same time, they were trying to transition to a much more online presence. So it was interesting to see the shift in communications. And as you say, it was before everybody started doing it in a really big way during COVID. But because it was always direct to consumer, there were some really key trends that I noticed when I started and that were really present the whole time that I was there. And I sometimes think there's a slight disconnect between what we do as what my role is now as a wine writer critic and what the public actually drink. Because one of the things that was really interesting to note was the most popular wines were all really big, rich, bold, mostly red wines, mostly with high alcohol, yeah, sometimes with sugar content. And then at the same time as, you know, these wines were booming for the company, in the rest of the trade you'd hear people talking about a shift to lighter styles of wines, low alcohol. And it was interesting to see how we could try and introduce some of those new styles without putting off the traditional customer base at the same time. And that's something that I still see in the market. Like if you look at supermarket shelves, you do see some of these, you know, you're obviously seeing a shift in the merchandising, and there's low alcohol, there's different styles of wines, but it's still the same sort of wines that keep selling. So it's interesting to see how the industry, I think, is going to cope with this dichotomy. But it's also interesting to see, you know, the language that you use in terms of trying to sell the wines to the consumer, because we can get really caught up in the wine trade using our language. And, you know, we talk about wines having a sense of, you know, a leathery taste or an oily taste or high acid, and all these things can sound quite confronting to consumers. So I loved that aspect of finding a wine and actually taking it to the consumer and explaining it to the consumer in a way that was really accessible and would clearly explain what that wine was in a non sort of wine geeky trade way.
And you're really good at that. And that's that general topic about the dichotomy. I've been thinking about that. In many ways, the global wine industry in lots of different regions have had very challenging years with rising costs, acute weather events, and we'll get to that a little bit later. But, you know, I think the revisiting of the connection with the consumer and what the consumer wants and what the consumer needs and what's going to drive that in the next 5 and 10 years. And actually, that kind of comes on to my next question. You've touched on some broader observations, I think, of what you're seeing in the industry with consumer trends and what they want and, you know, what that does with how you market and produce. So, you know, where I'm sitting here, these are things that we're talking about the industry in Canada or North America. You know, things like overall wine consumption is decreasing, even in France. Apparently, you know, consumers looking for lower alcohol or non-alc options, focus on sustainable, convenient packaging. You know, what regions are doing, ripping out vines, reducing production. So you're in London, you know, you're in a hub of a lot of the global wine trade. Would you say right now out there, you know, in the general landscape from the wine industry, are those the main points that you're hearing? I mean, there's a diversity of opinion, but would you say, you know, what does the wine industry look like in 5 or 10 years from now? Like, where are we heading?
Yeah, definitely. I think all of those things that you just touched on are things that I hear on a really regular basis. One of the most interesting things I think is the theme of sustainability, because a lot of the big companies, major retailers, major importers, I feel that they're not just now paying lip service to it, but there's an actual movement to try and change things, to try to make particularly packaging more sustainable. I'm not all around all of the details of it, but I know that there's a charter being signed so that the industry as a whole will move to lighter bottles, because the worst thing is if, you know, 80% of the importers move to lighter bottles, but 20% still keep putting things in heavy bottles and you know, consumers are attracted to that sort of look of a more premium bottle, and it doesn't really advance things for everybody. But there is a big push industry-wide to change bottle weight. It's something that I'm noticing as well around other countries. Definitely low alcohol styles, I think, is a really big issue. It's even more important in the UK industry at the moment, because there's a new tax system that's come into being, which hasn't really pleased anybody in the wine industry, because in fact now we have a much more complicated system than we ever had before Brexit, and alcohol will be basically taxed every 0.5% as it increases from 11.5. So obviously trying to get wines in at 11% has a real appeal from a financial point of view from importers. But that's problematic because then I know a lot of buyers and importers are trying to force wines from different regions into lighter styles where it just doesn't really work climatologically or, you know, in terms of the varieties that are planted. So that's really difficult. It was interesting. Last week I was in Rueda and tasted a really innovative product, actually, from one of the producers there that was 11% white wine made from Verdejo. But they were really clever in how they did it in terms of their picking date. And they were still working with old vines, so there was still concentration. It was really interesting. So that was probably one of the smartest examples I've seen. I guess my preoccupation with that sometimes is that we can get caught up talking around those topics. And while I understand for the UK, the financial implications with the taxation is important, I do feel that sometimes we spend so much time talking about niche parts of our market when we could actually, because I mean, low alcohol wines, they're increasing, it's booming, but off a really, really low base. So I think there's a lot of other really interesting things to talk about. And I think you touched just a minute ago on climate and how that's obviously affecting things. And, you know, it's obviously really difficult, but sometimes I'm really excited to be here in Spain because particularly with the huge amount of old vines that there are in Spain, they adapt so much better to these extreme climate issues. And also because of the altitude and people can keep going up a little bit in altitude, growers are looking at other ways of combating that. And I think that's probably a much, well, we all know it's a much bigger issue that affects everybody, but it'd be great to be talking a bit more about that in my point of view than low alcohol, I think.
Yeah. And that's something definitely I had on my list to chat with you today. And maybe we'll just jump there now, but I would like to come back to another English industry question, but I'll come back to that. So because you've raised this, and this is great. So perhaps we'll turn to Spain now where you are. And maybe just for context, before we get into that discussion on the old vines, can you just provide, you know, what are you doing in Spain? Why are you there? I mean, I know you focus, you've written some, you're starting to write more and more about Spain and Spanish wine regions for publications like Decanter. And I know that you do a lot of other writing, but can you just share, are you able to share what you've been up to broadly? You know, what's taking you there on this current trip?
So it's quite an interesting trip. Because I'm not quite sure when it's going to end, but that's exciting as well.
Perfect.
So last week I was actually out here with Tim Atkin, who's a master of wine, who writes and scores wines, particularly from Spain, which is his huge passion, but also Argentina and Chile, Uruguay. He loves South America. He also spends a lot of time in South Africa, and he has some other people writing reports in other regions like Burgundy, Champagne, and also the UK. But Tim and I have tasted a lot together over the years, and we feel passionately about putting more focus on Spanish wine regions and bringing them to life to a more international audience in a way that I don't think is happening at the moment in Spain. So I was out actually in Spain in November, December for over a month, tasting in Nevada and Aragon to write reports for him, which is something I need to do. I need to finish that in the next few weeks. And then he and I were out together in Rueda, which is, for people who don't know, it's about a two-hour drive west of, a bit northwest of Madrid. And it's a huge white wine producing region. And the main variety there is Verdejo. And there are a few other things, but it's mostly Verdejo. So we, what that week looked like was basically leaving the hotel at 8, visiting 8 wineries during the day, tasting, and then trying to squeeze in another tasting over dinner and then getting back about 11 p.m. at night. So it was crazy busy, but wonderful people. And I'll tell you one really interesting thing too that I hadn't quite realized, because we visited 50 wineries and I've never visited that many in the one region, not from Rueda, but it's heavily dominated by female winemakers and female winery owners. Yeah, it was really exciting because, you know, normally when I'm traveling, it's still really, really male dominated, and anybody who pretends it's not is kidding themselves, particularly here in Spain. And there are fantastic female winemakers, of course, don't get me wrong, but it's not unusual for me to be in a room, you know, with 6 men And then that's the same pattern for every visit. But it was, it's heavily dominated by female winemakers.
Wow. And are these like next generation from existing wineries and they're saying, hey, okay, we have daughters, or they're marrying in, or is it also new wineries where they're women founders? Yeah. Is it a combination?
It's a combination. And that's what's really exciting, because it's quite usual or common to find female winemakers who are daughters of, you know, owners and part of the family generations in. But here there was a real combination. And where they were from the family, there are some really young, dynamic female winemakers up and coming. And then there are people from outside who've come in from even other parts of Spain. And they're among the top winemakers in the region. So that was super exciting for me. It was just a breath of fresh air to me. Not that I have any problem with male winemakers, but it was really exciting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know we're jumping around a little bit, but this made me think of a question. Mm-hmm. Are there a lot of cooperative wine producers like in France and in Italy, you know, in Spain as well? So you'd have like négociants or cooperatives of communes who get together and make wines?
Yeah, so I'm really interested. It's actually interesting you asked that question, because it's something that I really want to focus on in the next few months. So Spain's heavily dominated by cooperatives. And I think it's in quite a different way from what I've experienced in other European countries. Funnily enough, Rueda doesn't have that many in comparison to other regions of Spain. But it's interesting, because cooperatives have played a huge part in the development of Spanish wine. And there are entire towns and villages which rely specifically on that co-op for their livelihood. So it's not just that it's a big machine producing volume, but it's actually really fundamental to the fabric of social life in the towns. And people, you know, particularly in the past, the landscape's changed a bit with more private enterprise, but people would be really proud of their cooperative. And actually, to be honest, this came up a little bit last week in Rueda, even though there are fewer co-ops there now. But in the past, people maybe didn't even refer to Rueda. It was a more recent appellation that was created. But they would refer to the wine of this town or that town, and people would know the style of that wine, you know, from that particular town. So it's really important. And I was talking to a producer in Nevada that's actually a private company. It was a family-owned business. But they took over the cooperative in that town. And it was so important for them to keep that history going and to involve the people in the village that they needed to get all of the socios, the people who are members of the cooperative, to sign the contract. And so they put on a bus, basically shipped the villagers up to Pamplona to sign the contract in the lawyer's office, brought them back down, had a big party. And so even though it's now a different ownership, the people of that village still feel like that winery is part of their village life. And I think that that exists in a way, in an even more sort of profound, fundamental way in Spain than it does in other countries.
So interesting. You know, people talk a lot about a sense of place and terroir. And when I hear wine industry people talk about what they think that means, there's often a broader expansion of, you know, the human geography of the place, and not just all of the climactic and aspect and soils and water. It seems to me what you've just mentioned about the commune maybe is that, where it's about the community, and that wine comes from the community, not just the dirt or, you know, the exposure your elevation.
It's the growers and it's their history. And what's really pleasing to see is, you know, I'm not saying this exists in every single co-op. I've visited a lot over my time, and there are varying standards. But one thing I've really seen change a lot over the last 15 years in Spain is the focus on quality coming out of a lot of cooperatives. So there's one particular cooperative I was in Calatayud in Aragon, and I think their wines are, you know, some of the best of cooperatives in that region. And one of the things that they're really doing is focusing on rewarding and paying well the growers with old vines, which obviously have lower yields. So if you're paying on the amount of grapes coming in, you're going to get less money if they're older vines. But what they're doing is putting premiums on them. And a lot of co-ops have these systems, but I really appreciated the focus that this particular co-op had in preserving high altitude vineyards on really special soils, just fabulous finds, and they've been really proactive in keeping that going. And I think you really can see that in their wines as well. They're a lot more complex and detailed and really representative of that particular mm-hmm. part of Calatayud.
And when you say old, you know, there is no legal definition for old vines. And I think different areas, it will be perhaps relative. You know, I'll touch on British Columbia shortly when we get to a chat about climate and acute weather events. But when you're talking about old vines, you know, we both know Australia has some of the oldest, Roussan and Garnacha and Shiraz in the world, because phylloxera did not wipe out a lot of it. But, you know, those are vines that are continuously farmed, but also, you know, a lot of people don't farm vines after a certain number of decades because of, you know, the lower production. So when you're talking about the old vines now, what kind of, you know, how old are you talking? What are these?
So, you know, can I
30
just thank
years,
you
for, 50 years?
Firstly, I need to thank you for saying Garnacha and not Grenache. Oh, yes. I appreciate it, because Garnacha, it is from Spain and it's originally yes. Spanish. So I appreciate that. Thank you. So that's what's extraordinary about Spain, is that the vines here are actually really, really old. So a lot of the time, you know, in France, you know, when I'm traveling around, people talk about old vines, and what they're referring to really are 20, 30-year-old vines. And here in Spain, to be honest, that's sort of peanuts, really. It's not uncommon for me to be tasting 100-year-old vines. And in fact, just take the example again of Rueda, just because it's fresh in my mind because I was there last week. They have a lot of old vines, 100 years old plus, because a lot of the region is sandy. And of course, yeah. Phylloxera couldn't, you know, survive in sandy soils. There are also amazing pockets of almost abandoned vineyards in Spain. So there was a real problem here in the last century with it's called the, you know, depoblación, so the big exodus of people from the villages into big cities to try and get work. You know, it's incredibly hard work in these vineyards at high altitude in mountains, which are really remote and isolated. And so a lot of the old vines were abandoned, but there's an absolutely fantastic wave of growers and winemakers in Spain who are going back to these old vineyards to try and recuperate them. So there are just pockets all over the place, and in some of the most wild and sort of exotic parts of Spain as well, sort of España Profunda, deep Spain. So I'm really bad at statistics, I have to admit. I'm not somebody who keeps stats in my head. I could Google it, but probably not fast enough. But my instinct is that Spain has one of the highest concentration of properly old vines, you know, sort of 80 right. to 100 plus years old in the world.
Fascinating. Yeah. I didn't appreciate that. I'm going to do more reading around that. Well, you know, and come taste with you sometime. that's easier. I'm not good at stats either. This is better taste. So you touch on the, you know, moving or rehabilitating vines, or I don't know if this is the same thing of what, you know, I know it's a different place, but, you know, Pedro Parra, like finding places that are maybe more on the edge or harder farming. So, you know, getting back to, you can't have great wine with great farming. And you're talking about old vines. So, you know, for context here in British Columbia, we've had some very, very challenging vintages on top of the economic climate of input, you know, increased costs globally that all producers are facing, things like that. But here, and we've had two very, very, very acute cold snaps, and that's an understatement. So that's really affected, you know, last year it's projected that more than 50% of the crop was lost. A lot of vines wow. Have died and had to be replanted. We've just 2 weeks ago had a very, very cold, acute weather event again. They're assessing the damage. And so, you know, discussions are, you know, it's farming. We are on the edge. We're on the margin, you know, we're in the 49th parallel in the Northern Hemisphere. We're on the edge. We have desert, but we also have cold. And so, here vinifera was really planted in the late 80s. You know, there was vinifera before. I'm talking about 1980s, not 1880s, not 1780s, not 1680s. So, you know, there's conversation about farming. So the actual practice of farming and farming practices in order to, and viticulture to deal with the what will be roller coasters, and also the grape variety, and whether we need to revisit mm-hmm. some of the vinifera and then also hybrids that will last. Mm-hmm. So that's just for context of where I'm sitting, and then a lot of the listeners here from British Columbia. So in Spain, you know, what's happening, and we hear what's happening in California, you know, So what in Spain, are there areas that are getting too hot?
Yeah.
Or is that what's happening and that people need to move? Is there a similar conversation happening, but, you know, for different weather and climate reasons?
For like the opposite reasons.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the biggest issue here in Spain over the last few years has been drought. It's been drastic really across the country. I mean, Priorat's really suffered, bits of Catalonia. It's ridiculous to pick out just a couple of regions because it really has affected almost all of Spain in terms of wine growing. But then again, this is one of the areas where having older vines actually has helped, because I know some of the producers that I've talked to recently have said things like, yeah, the drought's been, it's really affected them, but thank goodness they have older vines because they've adapted, they haven't completely shut down. But then, you know, having said that, I do know other producers where they haven't been as lucky. Speaking to a producer in Toro not that long ago, he lost, you know, over half of his crop last year because of the drought, because the grapes just, the vines just shut down too early in the season and he just couldn't harvest. So drought's a really, really big issue, and there's no easy solution to it. But as you said, the varieties are really important, but that's where Spain's quite lucky because there are so many indigenous varieties. And even when we talk about international varieties, if I pick out Navarra again as an example, in Nevada there's loads of Cabernet and Chardonnay that's been there for decades. So, you know, way even before British Columbia planted vines. So it's a bit of a polemic in Spain because there are writers and critics here who pretty much only want to focus, for example, in Nevada on Garnacha. And while Garnacha's, it's one of the best zones in the world for Garnacha, there's no denying as well that there's beautiful Chardonnay that's been made for such a long time now, and Cabernet as well, and it's part of the scene there. So those vines now have age as well. But what's interesting is there's sort of a return to find some of the kind of almost lost grape varieties in different regions. So going out to the border near Portugal in the area of Ribes or out near Salamanca or Zamora, varieties like Doña Blanca, you know, things that people haven't really got their heads around yet. There are pockets of really fantastic producers going back to these old vines and trying to recuperate them. But some of these indigenous grapes are really adapting a lot better to the climate. But I think it's been interesting. For instance, in Ribera Sacra in Galicia,
yes,
it's a region that, you know, it's really hot and trendy at the moment. It's up and coming. But again, they're really old vines. And I remember my first trip there quite a long time ago now. I mean, it was still half just completely abandoned because it's like you said, the cost and the effort to farm in some of these places, which are on sheer slopes, it's like the Mosel. And it's such different. I mean, over there they call it heroic viticulture, viticultura heroica. And it really is, because it's almost dangerous. So one of the things that we're really trying to look at doing in light of the need to put value back into these wines and also to value the old vines and indigenous vines in the context of climate change is, you know, some of us are really looking to try and talk about these areas and, you know, the reports that are writing and scoring the wines to try and put some more value back into Spanish wine, because that's one of the things that it really suffers from. So if we're going to try and fight these problems, whether they're social, economic or climate problems, we need to get people to buy into more expensive Spanish wines.
So the discussion old vines also probably for another time, but it reminds me a little bit also of what I'm hearing some very, very small producers are doing in California, which are rehabilitating vines that were planted in the 1800s. Different, you know, not Cabernet Sauvignon, not Chardonnay, but things that a lot of the Italian immigrant farmers came and had. They were dry farming. They were just starting and they planted some old like Carignan or other things. So I think this is what's happening in a lot of places. People looking at the roller coaster, Mother Nature. Mother Nature is the master here. and it's all about farming. So it's a fascinating discussion. I'm mindful of our time. I don't want to keep you too long from your evening in Spain. However, if you don't mind, I thought we could head back quickly to England, where I alluded to the fact that you are one of the judges for the Decanter Wine Awards. I know you've been judging for a while. Mm-hmm. I think you're a regional head, I think, with Central European Wines, if I'm not mistaken. And now you're you're a judge for the whole panel. For those who aren't familiar, and not many of us will have had the experience of being able to go and see this, can you just kind of describe, unless this is, you know, secret business,
right, but it's not secret.
what is it like in terms of, is it multiple rooms in one building? And, you know, how many wines, how do you do this? How many judges are there? How many wines over how many days, you know, in broad terms for people who have no idea? You know, you might pick up that Decanter magazine and you see the results of the words, and I'll see what Beth Willard said with the point. But like, what's the process like? How do you get to that publication at the end?
Yeah, it's really rigorous, and it's really exciting too when you arrive and you actually see it all set up. So I'm going to get in trouble now that I am actually one of the co-chairs of the competition. Oh. I'm going to get in trouble because I'm really bad at remembering numbers, like I said before.
Oh,
but I think that it's something like 40,000, 50,000 wines or something.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
well, we won't quote you. I promise. We won't quote you.
We can Google it later. I think it's around 40,000 wines, but
It's a lot. It's a lot. It's a massive, it's not just one room, right? It must be multiple rooms.
So what happens is there are sort of three steps to the whole process. And it's the thing that I love most about it isn't just tasting the wines. It's the collaboration with judges who come from all over the world. So the way that Decanter World Wine Awards differs from other competitions is that you taste in areas of specialty. So people who come into, like, for instance, yes, I was the regional co-chair for Central Eastern Europe and then also Spain. People who come into those rooms will be experts in Spanish wines, for instance, or know something about the regions to a certain level of a fairly impressive knowledge. So you're really dealing with people who know their stuff and who are usually really passionate about those regions, and they'll come from the countries themselves. So we get people from all over the place. So there's a real buzz. That first week is basically all of the regional judging. So everybody arrives. It's at Excel up in London, which is a huge big conference center. And it's really cool because it's right on the Thames River. So all of the rooms are in a row. And every region has its own room, basically. Some of the smaller regions share rooms. And I'm a terrible judge of distance, but it's probably, I think if you walk from end to end of all those rooms, it's over a kilometer. It's huge.
Oh my gosh.
So I only remember because one of the women who organizes the comp was complaining how much she walks during the day.
She counts her steps.
It's a lot of steps.
She got her 20,000, 10,000.
easily. And so the rooms all face out on the Thames, but backing onto that, is a glass wall where you can look down and actually see all the wines. And the team who organizes all of the wines is absolutely phenomenal. So they have them all laid out, all numbered. Everything's obviously tasted blind. And we have a wonderful team of support wine runners and people who organize the wines in the rooms for us who are just brilliant. So basically the only thing we know when we taste the wines in that first week, which is I'm pretty sure it's 6 days of judging. Obviously people come in and out of the different panels. But we basically only know the country, the region, the vintage, alcohol, and the price band, and a few other tiny technical details. So everything's done blind. The panels are usually four people. And what's really good about this competition is that each wine is discussed fully. So everybody writes notes and the scores are discussed. And we don't just take an average of the four scores. It's a negotiation almost. So people, you know, sometimes it's a very quick conversation. A wine might all be... Yeah, everybody might be on 89, fine, easy. But if there's a bit of difference within the panel, it's discussed to try and find the best score for that wine. So there's a lot of care and effort put into it. And then the following week, some of the regional chairs and the competition co-chairs retaste all of the wines that have been put through as gold medals. And this year we're actually going to include some of the wines on the cusp, so high silvers as well. And then we go through and decide if they're all actually golds, and also then push up into platinums for those really exceptional wines. And then the final step of the process of the co-chairs, of which I am now part, which is exciting, we taste the platinums and then decide the best in shows, the special awards for different styles of wines and regions. So it's a really intense very intense.
I can't. It must be mentally and physically exhausting. One, because your palate, and mentally because of the thinking. You know, I know after just a normal day as a kind of semi pro. I don't know, cork dork enthusiast. I'm exhausted after one day of the thinking and the writing the notes and then getting into the nuances of the differences of the wines. I mean, obviously they're different, but you're tasting scores of them. So it must be, everyone must be wrecked at the end of that, really.
Everybody
in a good way. I mean, in a good way. All you want, I know at the end of a day is I just want a cleanser, a cleansing lager at the end.
I think last year I didn't even really drink at the end of the day. I just needed like lots of sort of fresh sparkling water, just cold.
Yeah,
it's really we taste about 80 to 100 wines during the day, I guess. But in Spain, for instance, we tried to, it depends on the regional chairs, they can decide, but we tried to do all of the heavy reds in the morning, which actually made it much easier. By the time you're a little bit more fatigued after lunch, you could come back for the whites and the sparkling.
That makes sense. Because I often think, well, start the other way, but that would make sense.
It is hard, though, because, you know, sometimes you're tasting and there's just a wine that, for some reason doesn't speak to you. You're like, oh, I don't really know. But having that collaboration is fantastic. And most of the people are just brilliant and everybody's very accepting and respectful of everybody else's professionalism. Yeah.
And you're a professional. This is what you do. Like you're trained, you have practice. I remember when I was going through my WSET training and we were doing a lot of tasting at the end of the day, there was the 20th big red. And I think my notes just said, it tastes like wine. I was done. Tastes like wine, red wine. Like I had no words. And I usually have a lot of words. I have a lot of words. I'm like, wine. I was just thinking about this. Might put in a plug for one of our local wineries because I remember one of the first times I read some of your writing, if I recall in Decanter, was when one of our British Columbia wineries, Painted Rock, from the Okanagan Valley, I think was one of the wines of the year, wineries of the year, and for Decanter, I think it was three or four years ago. It's a blur, but I'll look, and I have a feeling that you may have been one of the judges. I just remembered that. Oh, I have to go back and check my notes.
You might be right because for the wines of the year, the regional chairs and the main contributors to the magazine nominate their wines of the year, and then a panel gets together and taste through them to come
that
up.
That was it.
I moved on the panel one year. Yeah.
So you'll have to come to British Columbia and we'll go there. We'll go there one day and we'll do a recording from on site.
That would be fun.
So I have so much more to talk about, but I think we'll leave it there. The talk of sparkling wine, my whole other topic I'd like to chat with you one day about is the English sparkling wine industry, which I think is fascinating. But I think we'll leave it. And then also Central Europe. Hopefully we can chat about that again. Yeah, there's so much to talk about, but I wanted to thank you today. I know you've been on the road. You've done so much for making the time in Spain and I know for you, this would have been very general, but that was really informative to hear some of your perspectives on Spain and some of the exciting things that are happening. I know we could really dive into a lot more detail on that, but just to get perspective on the future. You know, we look back a lot in wine. We look back at vintages. We look back at history. We look back where we came from. And I think that's really important for context. But I think it's time to look forward too, right? And I think in something that's very old, there's been, you know, wine and people have loved wine and making fermented drinks for thousands of years. But it's exciting that people want to keep doing it and the passion's driving us to do it however we can to make these really interesting quality small handmade wines. So thank
really
you
strong.
For sharing
No,
that.
Thank you. And I feel really strongly about that with Spain too. I mean, obviously I have a huge passion for the country, but part of the reason is this new wave of winemakers looking to the future, but doing that by drawing on their past. And it's something that we really need to talk about in Spain is the rich sort of heritage of wine in the country, but how that's actually coming through in these they're not actually new styles of wines. They're new to what foreign audiences imagine as Spanish wines.
Exactly.
But just wait, because there's going to be a huge boom in the next few years as you see more of these come into your market. And I'm so excited for these, you know, younger generation of growers and winemakers.
Well, thank you so much. And I would love to have other conversations with you. And also, you know, maybe in a couple of years, an epilogue to this one on Spain, and we can have an update, or I'll come there and we'll do it on the road.
Yeah, come here.
And I'd like to thank you for your multidisciplinary approach to wine exploring and to how you share your knowledge with people. I love your down-to-earth nature about it and your passion. And I'm really wishing you all the best for this year, for your continued travels in Spain and at the Decanter Awards. And I hope I can come back soon to your neck of the woods so we can do some more wine exploring. So thank you so much for joining today.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to my podcast today. If there are any topics or themes that you'd like to hear about, please drop me a line. I'd love to hear from you. And if there's a TT Wine Explorer podcast episode, which you hear and think would resonate with one of your friends, please share it with them. I'm all grassroots right now and would love for you to spread the word. Stay tuned for our next wine exploring adventure. And until then, take care, keep learning, tasting, and living.